Hi, I'm Larry Engelman. I'm an author of nonfiction works, articles, and books. And I'm doing an interview here on Sunday, October 30th, 2011, at my home in San Jose, California.
When did you know that you wanted to be a writer?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in a small town, not a suburb, but a small town in southern Minnesota, Austin, Minnesota, which is the home of the Hormel Company, and that's where they make Spam. So the town is about 100 miles from Minneapolis, the biggest town nearby city. I mention this because it was a provincial place, and the only college graduate, I think, that was in my, the only university graduate that was in the town may have been the local doctor. So there were many things we didn't know that people did for a living. We didn't know that there was such a thing. I remember when I went to college and I learned there was a major in philosophy, you know, or sociology or history. And certainly none of us when we were growing up thought there was an occupation called a writer, which is strange because we were so exposed to writing, particularly from Minnesota authors. I guess none of us stopped to think we could ever do that. We could even do it once. But I grew up not far from Sauk Center, which is where Sinclair Lewis grew up, and read, of course, his first stories on Minnesota Main Street being the principal one. But also F. Scott Fitzgerald, we all knew, was from St. Paul. And Ole Rolvaag, I suppose, who was the most popular author, was a Minnesota boy. His son was the governor of Minnesota, Carl Rolvaag, when I went to college. So we grew up in the midst of stories, let me put it that way. But none of us ever thought that we would be a storyteller, which I think is what a writer really is. I should point out, and I thought about this when you asked me the question previously, I remember the years after World War II when I was a little boy, and all of the local veterans came home. Many of them went in teaching, many were friends of my parents, including my dad had stories too. But they used to tell us stories about World War II, and we were utterly fascinated by this. In other words, I grew up in a storytelling tradition.
Oral tradition.
People told stories. And although we read Lewis and Rolvaag and Fitzgerald, none of us, you know, made the connection as to telling stories and being a writer. So we loved to tell stories. I told stories in high school. We told stories. We had book reports that were oral. But I went to college, you know, and in the aftermath of Sputnik. I went several years after Sputnik, but still the emphasis in college education, in college loans, because we all had to have loans, was technical education. So I started college as a math and chemistry major. I was going to be a scientist. And hopefully a rocket scientist. My organic chemistry teacher disabused me of that illusion my sophomore year. And at that time, I was we had to take certain courses, required courses. And among the courses I was taking as I began to search for a major were history classes. And my history teachers were fantastic, once again, storytellers. And so for me, nonfiction, as I thought it was at that time, or history, was the place where people who like to tell stories and like to hear stories went. So I majored in history and economics, graduated, got an MA in the two, because I was good at writing stories, researched stories. And then I went to the University of Michigan and got a PhD in history. Again, many of my teachers were the best storytellers. I mean, I remember classes in, say, the Roman Republic or 19th century Europe, where the instructors just told these fantastic stories. And, of course, then we would write these dry academic papers. So I was trained in writing really boring researched material that would lead to a degree. And I ended up teaching that when I came to San Jose in 1969. I got into writing, publishing, because teaching paid so poorly. And I had two daughters very, very soon in my marriage. So I was in California. I was earning $6,000 a year, I think, in 1970. And my wife and I were trying to... My wife was a student then, too, in graduate school at Stanford. So we were trying to figure out how to make money. And that's when I discovered that I could tell stories and people would pay me for them. I wrote a story for the local newspaper, Sunday Magazine, and I got paid. I don't know, not much, but I got a check. And that's when I decided...
Do you remember getting that check?
I remember getting that check. I was trying to remember what it was for. I would say $150, but I think it was much more than that. I'd ended up being... getting much more than that. So then I had written some academic articles for nothing, but and they always got the cover of the issues that they came out in. So I had this growing self-consciousness that I had a talent that the people around me did not have. So I continued writing. I mean, writing stories. I wrote a half dozen stories for the local newspaper, for the Sunday Supplement.
Oh, nonfiction.
Nonfiction, yeah. I wrote on Babe Ruth coming to San Jose. I wrote on a local tennis player. I wrote on an Olympic fencing team. I wrote on a blimp that crashed in Daly City in 1942. Stories that, you know, I would find in old newspapers from my research, and then I was able to sell. And I think it was the blimp story, the L-34, I think it was called, a very famous blimp that went out over the Pacific to look for Japanese submarines and returned without its crew and crashed in Daly City. I sent that to Life magazine. I remember this. And one morning I was having breakfast. I had no idea how to sell articles, but I was having breakfast. And the phone rang, and it was, hi, Larry, and said, this is Joan London. And I said, hi, Joan. I remember this very clearly. And she said, I published the article in Life magazine, and that's when they paid me, I think they paid $6,500. They paid me my annual salary for that piece. Joan London, anyway, read it. I read your piece in Life magazine. Yeah, I'd like you to be on Good Morning America. I said, great, you know, I thought I would stay here and be on the show. But anyway, they flew me out to New York. And this sort of was a change for me. It made me think I had legitimacy. I was writing good things. I was getting paid good money. And I remember my daughters picking me up at the airport when I came back from being on Good Morning America. And we went to a coffee house. And all of these people were in the coffee house with black turtleneck sweaters and berets and cigarettes. And they were thoughtfully writing. And I remember thinking, wait a minute, I'm a writer. You know, I don't look like that. I really am a writer, and people pay me for what I do. So that's when I started thinking, you know, writing is what I'm doing. It's not what other people pretend to be doing. So I became conscious, number one, that I had a talent. Number two, that I was on the right road. I sold my first book, Intemperance.
Is that period, do you recall ever going to a party or something and sort of telling somebody, yeah, I'm a writer.
Yeah, I do remember. I remember meeting a woman. I can't see her face, but I remember. I'll remember this as long as I live. And she said, what do you do? And I said, you know, because I didn't make much money as a professor, I said, I'm a writer. And I remember she looked at me and she said, you look so much like a writer. And I went over and I looked in the mirror, and I thought, what the hell is she talking about? You know, this is not me. So I had difficulty making that connection, me writing. But I began writing a lot, and I began selling. I sold a Smithsonian, Saturday Review, American Heritage, Maclean's Magazine in Canada, the Los Angeles Times, Sunday magazine, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer or Sunday magazine. I was doing well, and I sold a book to Free Press called Intemperance, which was on Prohibition. And I began writing a book on Helen Wills, the tennis player, called The Goddess and the American Girl. And I acquired an agent, a literary agent, along the way, Emily Jacobson, at Curtis Brown in New York. She had read my first book and gotten in touch with me. And it was at that point, I guess it was. And also then I started writing about Vietnam as a favor to my friends. And in, it was 1984-85, I signed two book contracts, one for The Goddess and the American Girl and one for Tears Before the Rain, the Vietnam book. And it was good money. I mean, I hate to talk about money like this. I hesitate. But when you work hard and you're supporting a family, getting paid for your work becomes important. You don't write for money. And I've never done that. I've never been promised much money before I wrote. But when you get paid for what you do, it's very, very nice. So in 1988, I published Goddess and the American Girl, and it was reviewed in the New York Times, and it was named by the New York Times one of the notable books of 1988. So that was great. And I remember I was in a room. I'd taken a job in China at that time, and I was in Washington teaching at Nanjing University. I was in Washington for an orientation program at Johns Hopkins, and a professor walked in, and he just bought my book at the university bookstore at Johns Hopkins, and he held it up. And I remember, gee, this was funny. I mean, it seems so superficial now, but everybody in the room stood up and applauded. And I thought, God, that's great. You know, that is really great. It didn't make it worthwhile, but it made me think I'd done something that was good. And I certainly didn't do it for those accolades at all. But and everybody thought I was really special. I'd done this 500-page book, you know, on two women in the 20s and 30s. And so I went to China, had a big adventure there, published Tears Before the Rain in 1991. And it was all such hard work. It was really, really hard work. It was thousands of hours. But I remember I was, another event, in 1991 I published that book, and I was asked to do a reading before a Vietnamese business association in San Jose. And I stood up, and it was mostly in Vietnamese, the people who were speaking. And they held up my book, and they introduced me, and I stood up to do this, still very touching. And these people, all these Vietnamese, a couple of hundred, they gave me a standing ovation. And I remember I couldn't talk. I burst into tears. And a woman who was with me on the stage comes over and put her hand on my shoulder and says, "You need to get more rest." You know? But you put in all of that time, and you really put your heart and soul into telling a story as well as you can. And then when you find it touches people or they appreciate it, and it just, you know, in a sense, your desire to write and your desire to write well, I think, is stoked by that. But by this time, I'd realized that the more you write, it's not the more you write, the easier it gets. The more you write, the harder it gets. Because if you're a good critic of yourself, you always realize what was wrong in your last book. And since you can't rewrite that, you go to work on the next one. So the next book I wrote is called Daughter of China. This is an interesting story. It was partly I was a character in this book. But I needed...
Before you do, why did you decide to write that book?
Because I lived in China for a year,
and the
story sort of came to me, you know, and I became involved with a Chinese intelligence agent, and the story was so beyond belief that I thought I would never write it out because nobody would believe it. But I got home and I thought about it, and I started to see the light, and I thought I would. So I applied for a sabbatical leave to write this book, Daughter of China. I'd done one chapter. And the committee, and committees are usually made up of, that give grants, are usually made up of people who can't do what they're judging. In other words, they can't write. But I remember I got a letter from them turning me down for a sabbatical leave, saying that they saw no possibility of publishing this story. But thank you very much anyway. And they gave something like 50 sabbatical leaves, and I didn't get one. Mm-hmm. Obviously, none of those 50 people were ever heard from again. The reason I tell this story is because I had another agent, Sandra Dykstra, who was Amy Tan's agent, approach me. She had read an article I'd written in the San Francisco Chronicle, and she wanted to represent me. So I sent her a 38-page section of this book, the first chapter. And she called me in the middle of the night. She called me about 11:30 one night. Now, there's a rule of thumb for writers. If your doctor calls you at 11:30 at night, it's bad news. If your agent calls you at 11:30 at night, it's good news. She said, I love this. I want your permission to take it to New York and to try to sell it. And I said, sure, you know. Now, I'm going to start mentioning numbers, and I mention these because they're true, not because I'm boasting, but I'd gotten a $25,000 advance for Tears Before the Rain. My agent went to New York, and on Thursday afternoon, I remember she called me, and she said, Larry, there's a bidding war on your 38 pages.
Every writer's dream.
And she said, Doubleday is offered $175,000. She says, but I think I can get Simon & Schuster to give $225,000 tomorrow. She said, the problem is there's no guarantee of that. And if we wait, Doubleday may back off. So it's up to you to make the decision what to do. So I said, well, let's go with the $175,000 was the advance, not the total package for the book. So I didn't know who to tell this to. I was so happy because none of the people that I worked with, number one, would be happy, nor would they understand, you know. And I remember telling the chairman of my department I was just going to sign a $175,000 contract. And I could tell he was looking at me like I was making this up, which I wasn't. So I took a year's leave, unpaid, from the university. But then, of course, the trouble begins because you sign a big contract, a massive contract, and you have to deliver the finished product within 12 months to their satisfaction. So for the next 12 months, I became a slave to that book. I mean, I remember I couldn't sleep at night. I knew I had to give a third, you know, in 4 months, a third and a third it was. And each time I gave them a third, I got more money. But I made the deadline. I got it in. And they published it. And it was published all over the world. So anyway, it was more.
How many languages?
More money. That was probably eight or nine languages, you know. I didn't know what to do after that. I mean, I'd done this book, and when you're writing a book, you very often don't think about your next book. And one day, I got a letter from this woman who was working at HP. She said she'd read Feather in the Storm. She had a good story. She'd like to tell it to me to see if I could help her write this. So I said, sure. By the way, this happens a lot. A lot of people stop me. Well, everybody's got a story, you know, and all I got to do is tell it to you and you write it. The funny part I'd left out before was they sold the movie rights to to Daughter of China, and that ended up being, I had never worked with movie people before, and that was pretty funny, because my agent, fortunately, Sandra Dykstra, God bless her, she helped me keep my head on straight. She said, Larry, people are going to be mentioning really big amounts of money to you. And she said, but remember, this money doesn't exist. And she said, because they're going to be paying for a movie, which also doesn't exist. So remember that, don't get flattered and don't tell anybody yes, because you're talking fantasy. And she was absolutely right. I mean, I was going to San Francisco almost every night. Some movie production crew was flying up, taking me, my wife and I, before we got divorced, out to dinner and promising us the moon. And so we signed a movie deal. And of course, the movie, it was also good money. That also ended up being community property. But the movie wasn't made, which happens with most of these deals. But anyway, it was a good experience. So I met Emily Wu. She worked at HP, and she had a story. And many people had come to me to write their story. But Emily had a good story, I thought. So Emily and I sat down, and I said, okay, I'll do another China book, although I wasn't really interested in doing another China book. My daughters made me promise I would not do another China book. My daughters thought I was too obsessed with that. So I wrote Feather in the Storm and sent it to my agent, and she sold that to my best publisher, Random House. And Random House really treated us royally, I should say. And it was good money. And I keep saying good money because, you know, you work on these things a year, 2 years, and you get paid for it, and it's really pretty good. What people don't realize also, you get paid for it, your agent gets 15%. What's left of that, the state and the federal government get 49%. So what sounds good isn't so good. That's the story of my writing, but it was a... I'm really conflicted on this, and if it sounds like I'm drifting off giving you facts rather than theories as to why I wrote, I long ago, after meeting so many people in writers' programs and writers' workshop, I decided that at least for me, I couldn't teach anybody really to do what I do. It seemed to me that my career in writing was more really a gradual realization that something in my background and something in my education, maybe something in my DNA, gave me the ability to tell a story honestly and dramatically and emotionally. And I couldn't teach that to anybody else. You know,
Do you think it's something you're born with?
I think that to a certain degree, I think many, I'm not the first to say this, I think a certain type of writing is craftsmanship, and that's writing papers for college, and that's writing newspaper articles. But I think for writing something that lasts and is published between two covers, and this isn't always true, writing becomes an art. And art, I think, is essentially a mysterious process. I remember there were so many times, I mean, I didn't want to drink too much. I didn't want to smoke marijuana because I was so afraid that whatever magic was happening in my brain would be damaged by this. In other words, I didn't know how I got this ability to tell stories, to see a story in a mess of facts. But I was aware that it was a special thing, and I just didn't want to lose it. So I've always been sort of careful of my mind about expanding it or contracting it, I guess. but there were certain things. I remember I was writing in Daughter of China. I was writing the story. I was writing a story about something that never happened to me, but it was a woman who gave away her daughter. It was a Chinese woman. This would be in the 1930s. She gave her daughter to her husband, to a newborn daughter, to trade for a newborn son from a family that already had a son. But the husband found that the other family didn't want to trade the son, and so he, on the way home, threw the baby girl into a canal and then came home just with the blanket. And the grandmother kept the blanket in her box of goods for the remainder of her life until one day her granddaughter opened up this box. And there was this blanket, and all the blood had turned to crystalline and fell out on the floor. I remember writing that, and I saw it in my mind. Every time I write, I try to see the movie in my mind. to quote a line from Miss Saigon. And I started to cry. I started to really cry, and I couldn't stop crying. And I tried to read this section to my wife, and I couldn't. I just broke down. And I didn't understand what was going on either, but it seemed that... it's going to sound funny saying it this way, but in good parts of writing, it always seemed to me that I had that something in me had connected with something in somebody else, somebody even who didn't exist anymore. And I was able to put those feelings down as well as I could on paper. And as I said, it affected me so deeply, I felt almost like the woman who had done what I was writing about. So I don't know really how to teach that to somebody. So it takes a lot of empathy, and it takes a lot of sympathy, and I think it takes a lot of living. I tell you this, I mean, one of the things that I object to from so many people I've met who are writers is they haven't lived. They haven't done anything. I think John Irving, who's a wonderful writer, used to be a wonderful writer, would be one of those guys. It started out, I love The World According to Garp, and I love Cider House Rules, but the guy doesn't seem to have done anything except live in Iowa City and attend writers' workshops. He hasn't lived life. And the people who inspired me, Fitzgerald, Hemingway in particular, who probably inspires all American writers, and Sinclair Lewis, they did things. They lived life. And I had someone tell me, oh, yeah, but they lived in a writer's community also. Hemingway lived in Paris. This was just a conversation I had with another writer yesterday. I said, yeah, but when he wanted to write, he went to Key West, or he went to Idaho, or he went to Spain. You know, he didn't hang around in a group in a seminar. So I think it takes a lot of living to empathize and sympathize. And I think the problem with a lot of writers who have early success is they haven't lived. They haven't felt enough. You can tell when they're faking it. So I've told people before who wanted to write or who wanted to live, I said, get a damn ticket and go somewhere, you know, and stay for a long time. And you know what? They won't do it. They don't do it. People don't realize if you've never been out of California or never been out of the United States, people tend not to realize how different you feel about yourself when you go somewhere else, I think, and you're a stranger. I mean, again, this is true for me. Again, I'm speaking as though this is a universal truth. This is true for me. I suppose people do what they do, you know, and... But this has been true for me. I remember people coming in and says, how did you ever write this book, Helen Wills? And I, you know, you say, I sat on my ass in that room upstairs for 5,000 hours. If you do that, you probably could do the same thing, you know, but you can't do it for 1 hour. So you're right. You can get all the experience you want. You can read all the writers you want. But in the end, you can sit on your ass, attach it to a chair, and not get up. You got to write. It's thousands of hours. I tell you, I pick up the Helen Wills book, or I pick up Tears Before the Rain, and I look at that, and I think, I did that, or I've done 6 books. I say, I did that, and I have no doubt in my mind that, thank God for stupidity in writers, if I realized when I started the book how many hours I was going to put in on it, how much energy, how much creativity I was going to put in on it, I would never do it. And it says, I think my mother used to say that about having children. She had 5 of them, you know. But she said every time right after you have a baby, you say, I'm never going to do that again, you know. And then somehow you forget. So you turn around and you start another book. But, you know, now people ask me on this, I call it my murder book, you know, the Our Share of Night. But, you know, I've been working so goddamn long on this. And now I don't know what to say. You know, now it's been so long that you can't give up. You got to finish it. But on the other hand, you wonder if you could ever start it. My agent called it, my first agent, Emily Jacobson, has called it the iron umbilical. When you write a book, she said, you connect yourself to it with an iron umbilical. And she said, and you have to realize that at some point you're going to have to sever that, but it's very, very difficult. So, and particularly, I think, Goddess and the American Girl, God, I think there was 550 pages. And people don't realize, kids don't realize, I think, particularly young ones who come to you and say, oh, I want to be a writer. You know, books don't come to you in paragraphs. They come to you word by word. They come to you syllable by syllable. They come to you sometimes letter by letter. And, you know, it's the same way someone who paints a great picture does, you know. And I've been approached to teach writing nonfiction, but in a sense, I've always thought that doing that was a con game. I mean, I hate to put it that way, but I can't think of anything else. I mean, you're wasting the time of the students and you're wasting your own time because, as I said, to do it, you just sit down and do it. I mean, thank you for saying that, but very often I try to figure things out when I talk to myself. I simply know how I do it. You know, it's like somebody asks you, how do you ride a bicycle? You know?
I got 1 minute of tape left.
Sure, okay, go ahead.
No, you go for it.
Oh, you know, how do you ride a bicycle? You can't figure it out. You just do it. You tell somebody how to do it, but you can't reason your way into it. So, and I very often thought, by the way, I should say in my English classes at the University of Minnesota when I was fascinated by Minnesota writers, I think the English classes really ruined the fun of it for me. story reading should be fun. And storytelling should be, as you near the end, fun. Maybe it's easier for some people, but it's not easy for me.
Well, you've been a great storyteller here. You've had a bunch.
Well, thank you very much.
You shared it. Love it.
I was reminded when you said the computer story, this is a true story, and this is actually from Walter Isaacson's biography of Henry Kissinger, that when Kissinger became National Security Advisor in 1969, he had the entire State Department and Defense Department program a master computer. And they put in all the statistics about the United States and the military and the economy, then all the statistics about North Vietnam and the military and the economy. And then they, after programming it with all of this information, they asked, when will we win the war in Vietnam? And the story was that the computer churned away, and finally it spit out the answer and it said, you won in 1966.
Guess what? Thanks, my man.
Yeah, you're welcome.